This Weekend starts right after this.
Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. Fortunately, Geico makes it easy to bundle your home and car insurance. It's a good thing, too, because having a home is hard work. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. Geico.com. Easy.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This Weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
Helping kids readjust. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
As pandemic restrictions fade, it's time for children to start interacting face-to-face again at places like summer camp. Will they be ready?
On the personal finance front, the core notions that can help us manage our money more prudently.
The Michigan woman who customized a van so she could work while visiting national parks. Here are the comforts that she built.
And how the University of Nebraska plans to help its recruits cash in on their name, image, and likeness.
That's something that's attractive to athletes. You know, if they can get some sort of sponsorship or build a brand for themselves and profit in a way that college athletes have not been able to before, if they go to a state like Florida or Nebraska versus a state like Minnesota or New York, then that's definitely something that's going to factor into their college decision.
Lane Higgins at the Wall Street Journal on the hottest recruiting pitch in college sports. Experts say tornadoes are occurring with more frequency in Alabama and elsewhere in the South. And overall, especially recently, tornadoes just haven't behaved the way they used to. They occur in big outbreaks more often and happen earlier and later in the year. It's a story by Doyle Rice, weather reporter at USA Today. Doyle, what are we learning?
It was kind of surprising when we did this analysis that everyone thinks of tornadoes as being kind of centered in Tornado Alley, which is the part of the central U.S. that includes states like Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, you know, traditionally where you think of the Wizard of Oz type tornado that you could see for miles on end there out in Kansas. Whereas our data found that some of the biggest increases in tornadoes in the United States over the last few years have been in the South, in the Southeast. States like Alabama, Tennessee, Georgia, Mississippi, that should probably be considered more Tornado Alley than the traditional location where everybody thinks of in the Midwest.
And it should newly be considered that way, or it should always have been considered that way?
Well, these things appear to be increasing in the Southeast. So at one point, it was probably accurate to call Tornado Alley the states there in the central U.S., but now, due to the factors that scientists aren't quite exactly sure why, it appears that tornadoes are hitting more frequently and more deadly in the Southeast than they are in the central U.S., so it was kind of a surprise.
All right, so is this the way the weather pattern is right now, or are we getting better data reporting these things?
That's part of it, yeah. In the last 20 years, with the amount of people that have cell phones and the amount of chasers that are out there, and everybody's on top of these things, scientists say that it could be partly due to the fact that we're seeing more of these, we're reporting more of these, that they may have already been there, but we just weren't reporting them. And now we're seeing a lot more of them. But they said that only could explain some of the discrepancy, that there's not a clear answer as to why this is happening.
Wow. We're speaking with Doyle Rice, weather reporter at USA Today. They've got a good story entitled "Twisters Are Hitting More Frequently and Dealing More Deaths in the South." The most popular kind of tornado is what?
The vast majority of tornadoes are very weak. Yeah, you know, there's the scale of tornadoes that we're pretty familiar with that goes from EF0 to EF5, and the EF0 being the weakest, EF5 being the strongest, and by far most tornadoes that hit are of the weaker variety that cause damage and can cause some injuries and even an occasional death, but by far the ones that are the most common are the weaker ones. The U.S. now hasn't had an EF5 tornado in several years, and we're very fortunate that it's been a while since we've had a very powerful EF5 tornado hit the U.S.
And I feel like so many times when I report tornadoes on our program that it involves mobile homes or mobile home parks. Why is that?
Yeah, there's a myth that tornadoes are attracted to mobile homes, and that's obviously not the case. They don't know what's down there when they're popping down out of the clouds. It's just that the construction of mobile homes is so much less sturdy than of a regular, well-built, constructed home, that when a tornado does hit a mobile home, it causes colossal damage. Often can destroy a mobile home, whereas that same tornado would not cause nearly as much damage to a well-constructed, freestanding single-family home. So mobile homes are not the place to be during a tornado outbreak.
With the number of storms apparently on the rise, and the number of tornadoes on the rise, are our warning systems any better?
Right now, the U.S. averages about 9 minutes in between when the tornado warning is issued and when a tornado actually touches down. Scientists are working hard on this to try to increase the lead time so that people get a better warning when a tornado is coming.
That's Doyle Rice, weather reporter at USA Today. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Is there something interfering with your happiness? We're all dealing with a lot right now. I'm sure you feel the same kind of added stress I do. Then you should know about BetterHelp. BetterHelp isn't a crisis line. It's not self-help. It's professional counseling done securely online. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. Start communicating in under 48 hours. Schedule weekly or monthly phone or video sessions or whatever works for you. BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. That's why there's a special offer for This Morning with Gordon Deal listeners. 10% off your first month. Visit BetterHelp.com/Gordon. That's BetterHelp.com/Gordon. And join the over 1 million people who've taken charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp, they're recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. That's 10% off your first month at BetterHelp.com/Gordon.
The news without the nonsense. You're listening to America's First News, This Weekend with Gordon Deal.
Thanks for being with us. For more than a year now, we've been telling our kids they have to stay away from others. Big groups can be dangerous, and masking up will keep grandma safe. But with restrictions largely lifted, now it's time for summer camp. But are the kids ready? What to do if your kid seems suddenly anxious about being around people again? From Dr. Catherine Athens, psychologist and licensed family therapist. Doctor, what are you hearing?
Oh, it's really something, because I have parents calling in all the time saying, my kid doesn't want to leave the house. My kid doesn't want to go back to school. My kid doesn't want to do anything. My kid's angry. So what do we do about it? I say, oh, let's start small. Let's just do something out in the backyard with your kid or at a park with your kid. Maybe invite another child. Summer camp is great if you have summer camp, if they want to go. A lot of kids don't want to go anywhere, so I'd say get one or two other kids and start small.
Mm. Are there particular ages where this is of notable concern?
You know, it starts around 8 years old. 7 in earlier doesn't seem to be quite as much of a problem. But when we start getting 8, 9, 10, we start getting into the kids being very social. And what I hear from the kids is, well, you took all my friends away. I couldn't see my friends for a year. Now you expect me to just jump right back in, and maybe my friends have even moved away.
Jeez,
you know, so unfortunately, with all this lockdown, I don't think we considered the emotional health of children really at all.
Yeah. All right. So it's day one of camp. You've packed the bag, ready to go. You've applied the sunblock, and the kid says, I'm not going. I hate this. No way. Do you make the kid go?
Well, I think what you do is sit down and say to the kid, okay, why don't you want to go? And what if I went with you? What if we got a friend to go with you? What is it you don't want to do? Tell me what's going on. Hopefully parents have had the opportunity with this shutdown to speak to their kids more and to get to know what's going on. Sometimes the kids are afraid that they won't measure up to the other kids. Mm. Sometimes they're afraid that now they've been a year plus without socialization. Are they going to say the right thing? Are they going to do the right thing? Are people going to call them a dork or whatever they do, call yeah. them nowadays? So I'd say sit down with your kids, say, let's talk about this. Mm. You know, let's talk about what are your fears? What are your angers? What if I went with you? What if we, you know, if what if you just saw what it was like? Usually kids don't want to go, and then when they go, they see other kids, and they go, bye, Mom, bye.
Yeah, yeah. So the old phrase, you're embarrassing me, get out of the car and get into camp, is not probably a good idea.
No, oh, no, no. That will just cause more problems. Yeah. So I think kids are so much more verbal these days. And I know when I talk to kids, you know, usually what I do is I lay on the floor and I look up at them so they feel they have some control. I tell parents, get below their level. Mm-hmm. And that way, you know, you're not this huge person looking down on this little kid. Because
yeah.
that's scary enough as it is. And try to use some humor. Try to talk about, you know, I feel this way. What do you feel? Share some things with your kid. Generally, kids will, after talking it out, not refuse to go.
Mm. We're speaking with Dr. Catherine Athens, psychologist and licensed family therapist. We're talking about helping your kids adjust to being around people again, especially as they might head off to summer camp and be anxious about it. I guess camps might have a role to play here, too.
Absolutely. I think the camps have a heads up on this. I think their personnel have been trained to take a look and, you know, and seek out who might be a little traumatized and try to engage them in conversation and find out why, you know. Yeah. Maybe the kid doesn't like what they're wearing or their haircut or, you know, you don't know mm-hmm. because kids get very upset about things we don't think are that important, but yeah. they are to the kid.
Thanks, Catherine. Dr. Catherine Athens, psychologist and licensed family therapist. 21 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Coming up next, the best recruiting pitch in college sports.
This is a metaphor for your business's journey. Sometimes it feels like the world is throwing everything it has at you. And to succeed, you need someone to guide you through. That's what Dell Technologies Advisors do. They have the tech advice to help you navigate whatever challenges you're up against and get you safely to where you want to be.
For advice on solutions like XPS 13 laptops powered by Intel Evo platform, call an advisor today at 877-ASK-DELL.
Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. The University of Nebraska is angling hard to be at the front of the pack in persuading recruits it can help them take advantage of a new era of compensation for college athletes that is dawning. Nebraska will be among the first states to permit college athletes to make money from their name, image, and likeness. We get more from This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
The hottest recruiting pitch in college sports these days, we can help you cash in. With new rules coming that allow for some forms of compensation, some schools are touting their ability to help student athletes monetize their image. Here with more, Lane Higgins of the Wall Street Journal. Lane, what's the latest on making money from NIL or name, image, and likeness across the country?
Well, it's a rapidly changing space, but as we know it, July 1st is the all-important date where there are, I think, six states as it stands on, you know, today at this very moment that will allow athletes to profit and own the rights to their name, image, and likeness, which means they could sign autographs for money, they could do endorsements, they could become influencers on social media. And, you know, this is something that's coming, and it will likely be used as sort of a recruiting tool in college athletics just because that's something that's attractive to athletes. You know, if they can get some sort of sponsorship or build a brand for themselves and profit in a way that college athletes have not been able to before, if they go to a state like Florida or Nebraska versus a state like Minnesota or New York, then that's definitely something that's going to factor into their college decision. So it's sort of this brave new world where we don't really know how everything's going to work out because it hasn't happened yet, but it looks like it's going to fundamentally change college sports when it does.
Your story takes a hard look at Nebraska. What does Nebraska say they're doing?
So Nebraska has actually been pretty early on the bandwagon for supporting its athletes in this way. And they were one of the first schools to partner with Open Doors, which is a company that basically facilitates the deal. So athletes can create profiles and then brands can say, hey, I want a spokesperson for my, you know, sub shop that's going to advertise on their Instagram. And maybe an athlete who really likes sandwiches can then connect and see that and say, hey, yeah, I'll do it. And then it helped them with, you know, some of the legal filings, some of the 1099s for tax purposes, and, you know, basically just makes that process a little bit easier to navigate for everyone involved. And then on top of that, in the last year, Nebraska's been sort of ginning up this idea of how it can best use the resources on campus to support athletes. So it said, you know, we have a great business program. We have a great College of Journalism. We have a law school. Like, let's use those to whatever end we can. So they're starting these new pop-up classes where an athlete can work with someone that's in the law school and create an LLC for themselves in order to, you know, monetize their podcast maybe. Or they can work with the College of Journalism to rent equipment to film a video, to have a blog. And one thing that's a little bit unique about this is that obviously the student athletes are people that are going to benefit from this, but the students that are enrolled in these other programs at Nebraska that might not be athletically inclined can work with them. And that way, if you ever want to have a career in sports marketing, you can get that real life experience while you're still an undergrad. So it's kind of a little bit of a different way of approaching this in that a lot of other universities are offering programming just to athletes, but not necessarily under the guise of the programs that they already have on campus.
Are there concerns this will make the big schools bigger and the small schools even smaller in a way?
Oh, certainly. And, you know, it's hard to say that that's not already happening in some ways because, you know, you look at the facilities war in college football where it's just who can have the latest, greatest, you know, video game console in their locker room. And, you know, the schools that can't afford that, yes, the ways that they're going to be able to profit off of name, image, and likeness for their athletes are going to be different. But, you know, if I was a Division III swimmer, I could still go home to my hometown and hold a Learn to Swim clinic and charge, you know, little kids for swim lessons and make money off of that. That's not something I can do now. So the opportunities are still there. It's just a matter of scale. So, yes, the scale is probably going to be much greater for some of these athletes at the top Power 5 programs.
We're speaking with Lane Hingetts of the Wall Street Journal. Lane, of course, everybody, you know, football comes to mind right away because it's such a money driver. But I've been reading a lot about how the name, image, likeness will help women athletes, especially in some of the Olympic sports. Why would that be?
So Olympic sports tend to have these really niche followings online. Like, gymnastics fans are insane on Instagram. And there are a lot of gymnasts that have, like, close to 100,000 followers. And that turns into a pretty big amount of money if you partner with, you know, say, a leotard company and you want to advertise. Like, that means that you can get paid a lot half your sum if you have 100,000 followers versus 1,000. And I think that there's a lot of opportunities for these women, A, based on their social media followings, and then B, based on the fact that there's not a lot of pro opportunities for women in some of these Olympic sports.
It's Wall Street Journal sports reporter Lane Higgins with this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
Innovation, resilience, agility. It's how Michigan businesses work together and continue to build the future. Our expertise, talented workforce, and collaborative environment are making a difference now and shaping the future. Join us and make your mark where it matters. Visit michiganbusiness.org/radio to put your plans in motion. That's michiganbusiness.org/radio.
Advancing the conversation, identifying trends, and informing the world. You're listening to America's First News This Weekend with Gordon Deal.
Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, colleges split on requiring vaccines for students. Also, tips on better money management, plus the severe blood shortage in the U.S. And the Michigan woman who plans to visit every national park while living and working in her custom van. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Well, colleges and universities everywhere face daunting challenges, logistical and political, as they try to create safe campus spaces for living and learning in a nation weary of the coronavirus and divided over masks and vaccines. The big questions for administrators: mandating vaccinations or just encouraging them? And then how do they know which students have received shots? More from Isaac Stanley Becker, national political reporter at The Washington Post. Isaac, quite the patchwork.
It is a patchwork. We are seeing this discussion and debate play out across sectors and fields, but education is certainly one of the most interesting ones. And, you know, it's building up to this point in the fall when all of this, of course, is going to become sharply into focus in terms of what's required where on what campus. If I'm a student attending X university but not Y university, or I'm a parent, it's a fascinating terrain for this issue.
All right, so you open the story by comparing Indiana University and Purdue University, two big public schools in Indiana, and two different approaches.
That's right. So Indiana University is requiring students as well as employees to get vaccinated against the coronavirus, whereas Purdue is encouraging it but not requiring it, with the president saying that a requirement or a mandate might backfire, that it would come across the wrong way, as ham-handed. So we thought that was a pretty interesting example of, even in the same state, even somewhat similarly situated universities were coming to different decisions, because elsewhere we've seen that there are differences that can be broken down by, public and private. It's easier to do something if you're a private institution. And then also, of course, geography and political geography. We've seen that this is easier for universities in blue states to implement than in red states, where governors have moved against such mandates and requirements or certification systems known as vaccine passports.
So even if schools mandate a vaccine, how do they know who's vaccinated and who's not?
Well, there are different ways of certifying this, and already we know that there are various health requirements, vaccination requirements for attending university, and there's a process whereby that would have to be certified. But you raise a good point, and there's the related point that there are certain medical as well as religious exemptions, and any university or other institution that is requiring this has to account for that. And in some ways, that's an argument that some people use for these requirements, that because there are some people who can't do it, because there are some people who are immunocompromised, are therefore vulnerable even with the vaccine, you want broad compliance to ensure general safety, to keep infections down.
We're speaking with Isaac Stanley Becker, national political reporter at The Washington Post. His story is called "Colleges Want Students to Get a Coronavirus Vaccine, but they're split on requiring the shots." I forget which school it was, but one of them promised for those who are fully vaccinated, they'll have kind of opportunities to do more things on campus.
Right. And this, too, is something that we're seeing not just in higher education, but also in employment context, that there are certain allowances made. But the understanding is that if you don't get the shot, you might have to have certain opportunities curtailed, or you might have to not have a kind of, in employment context, a front-facing position.
How much is there a blue-red divide politically when it comes to what states are doing what with schools?
There are counterexamples in terms of similarly situated universities in a given state. Say, we discussed the example of Indiana coming to different decisions in this respect, and we're also seeing private institutions in red states make certain decisions that public ones aren't.
Thanks, Isaac. Isaac Stanley Becker, national political reporter at The Washington Post. Coming up next, managing money more prudently. In the sport of business, we're all players, and with the game always changing, you need to be versatile. So does your wardrobe. You want both style and comfort to look as good as you feel inside the office or out. That's what Cuts Clothing is all about. Cuts Clothing keeps you sharp wherever the game takes you, from the boardroom to the bar to the gym. How? They reinvented men's clothing, starting with the t-shirt. Their Pika Tri-Blend fabric is buttery soft, wrinkle-free, and keeps its shape. Everything I've worn from Cuts is next-level comfort. Their polos, hoodies, and crew sweatshirts, all classics, made modern with custom-engineered fabrics you have to wear to believe. So versatile, you'll never need to take them off, and so comfortable, you won't want to. It's not just the lifestyle. It's not just clothing. It's office leisure apparel for the sport of business. Get 15% off your first order by going to cutsclothing.com/Gordon. That's cutsclothing.com/Gordon for 15% off the only shirt worth wearing.
Hey, don't forget to check out a podcast of the program. You can find it on our website, which is thismorningwithgordondeal.com, or on all the
favorite podcast platforms. What does it take to manage money prudently? Yeah, we should save diligently, favor stocks, diversify broadly, hold down investment costs, and buy the right insurance and that. But all these smart financial moves stem from key assumptions we make about our lives and the world around us. Jonathan Clements at HumbleDollar.com has a handful of core notions. Jonathan, what have you come up with?
So, Gordon, when we think about all those rules of money management, things like, you know, we should diversify, we should favor stocks, we should hold down investment costs, buy the right insurance, and so on, underpinning those, I believe, are five core assumptions that we apply to our financial lives and to the world around us. And, for instance, the first assumption is that we're going to live a long life. We should assume that we will indeed make it to age 95 or 100. This is might seem like a good thing, but actually a lot of people don't think this way. They think that the world is pretty much going to end tomorrow, which is why they live for today. It's the reason that they overspend, the reason they don't save for retirement, the reason they claim Social Security as soon as they're eligible. And so what I would say to people is, if you want to manage money prudently, one of the first things you should do is assume that tomorrow will indeed happen. And in fact, you should assume that you will indeed live into your 90s and manage your money accordingly.
I think we all struggle with that sometimes. You know, just for me personally, right? I'm a big soccer fan. I watched this 29-year-old player from Denmark essentially die on the field before he was resuscitated on Saturday. I thought, he's 29. This is a premier world athlete who just collapsed. You know, you could envision that happening to you. Why shouldn't I try to live in the moment? You know, it's tough to wrestle that sometimes, to wrestle with it.
Well, first of all, Gordon, you should think about the odds. If you're age 20, there is a 90% chance that you are going to make it to retirement age. You know, one day you will indeed live without a paycheck, and it takes a lot of money to live comfortably in retirement. You know, you are not going to be comfortable living on Social Security alone. But beyond that, the fact is that living paycheck to paycheck, living in the moment, is actually enormously stressful from a financial point of view. I mean, when you don't know that you can handle, you know, a big emergency expense, whether it's, you know, losing your job or the car breaking down, I mean, that is a prescription for multiple bad night's sleep. By contrast, if you save for the future, if you know that you're doing what you need to do and ensure the decades ahead are going to be good, you're going to sleep a lot better. You're going to have far less financial stress.
We're speaking with Jonathan Clements. He's the founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. He's written a piece called Get an Attitude, in which he talks about the core notions for prudent money management. Another one you said would be good things will happen to the economy. Explain that.
So one of the things that, you know, I hear all the time, I get emails from readers all the time about how they're nervous about the stock market. You know, I even hear from people who've decided to bail out of stocks entirely because they're nervous about some aspect of the economy, accelerating inflation, higher taxes, political upheaval, whatever it is. But it's a matter of good money management. We should assume that good things are going to happen to the economy, and therefore we should be happy to own stocks for the long haul. Yeah, there are going to be bumps along the way, but the fact is, most of the time, the economy isn't growing, and because the economy is growing, corporate profits are rising, and because corporate profits are rising, stock prices climb over time.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, founder and editor at HumbleDollar.com.
This is a metaphor for your business's journey. Sometimes it feels like you're going 100 miles an hour, barely keeping up. But to cruise through challenges, you need someone who's right there with you. That's what Dell Technologies advisors do. They have the tech advice you need to get past whatever's in front of you and get to where you want to go. For advice on solutions like XPS 13 laptops powered by Intel Evo platform, call an advisor today at 877-ASK-DELL.
Thanks for being with us. The Red Cross is experiencing a severe shortage of life-saving blood in the wake of complications from the COVID-19 pandemic. Experts are seeing a 10% rise in red cell demand from hospitals with trauma centers in 2021, more than five times the growth of other facilities that provide blood transfusions. The current shortage is keeping life-saving blood from the hands of hospitals in need. A further explanation from Dr. Dayan Borge, Regional Chief Medical Officer for the American Red Cross. Doctor, what's the Red Cross facing?
Well, not just for us, but for the entire community. What we're seeing is an impressive increase in the demand for blood products. And this isn't something that just happened overnight. It's been ongoing for about several months, really. And it's related to just recovery after the pandemic, and it's a portion of that whole pandemic effect. We had so many folks that had to have their care delayed because of either regulations that were in place or just, you know, not feeling comfortable to go to the hospital, or even just not availability of beds and the services at the hospitals in dealing with the COVID pandemic. Mm-hmm. What's happened is that now those folks actually need that care. They need to come in and get those elective procedures. Some of those elective procedures have now turned into more emergent procedures because people have gotten sicker. Some other things that have been delayed are now trying to be pushed through, and hospitals are, you know, now using their capacity to deliver more and more of this care to get the patients through. But what it's done is it's created a draw on the overall blood inventory. So while we were expecting there to be a surge in activity, the surge that we've seen is certainly not anything we were expecting. In some cases, we're seeing anywhere from a 5 to 10% increase in the demand for blood products. And while we're collecting even above what we were planning to do in anticipating this surge, that surge in activity is just far outstripping our ability. Wow. And you add on top of that the fact that traumas compared to 2019 have increased by 10%. At the same time this is going on, that just further draws on our blood supply.
By the way, why? What's with a 10% spike in trauma?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things that we could point to. For one, probably more people trying to get out and get back and do the things they like to do. Not 100% sure why we see more accidents and things like that, and reasons for people having to get blood in traumatic events. We have, though, sadly, seen an increase in certain activities that cause injury, either through penetrating trauma, through gunshots or stabbings and that kind of thing, in certain geographies. Certainly, even where I live, we've seen an increase in this, even compared to last year.
Mm. We're speaking with Dr. Dayan Borge, Divisional Chief Medical Officer at the American Red Cross. We're talking about the severe blood shortage. So what's needed?
Well, what we need right now is we just need the public to not forget that donating blood and having blood available for patients is something that is part of our community responsibility. But also, we can't just make this in a factory. We rely on people to come out and help support us. And that's not to say that the American public hasn't been doing it. They've been doing that pretty well. But this is the time of year where people start to have other things on their mind. And again, with people being a little bit more allowed to do more things that they haven't been doing in the last year, sometimes donating blood is not at the top of the priority list. Yeah. But we need not only that support now, we're going to need it throughout the summer because, as I said, this pull on blood has not just happened overnight. It's been happening over months. So we're going to need that continued support in the months to come.
Thanks, Doctor. Dr. Dayan Borge, Regional Chief Medical Officer for the American Red Cross. Coming up next, a Michigan woman's national park mission in her van.
Innovation. Resilience. Agility. It's how Michigan businesses work together and continue to build the future. Our expertise, talented workforce, and collaborative environment are making a difference now and shaping the future. Join us and make your mark where it matters. Visit michiganbusiness.org/radio to put your plans in motion. That's michiganbusiness.org/radio.
Jasmine Wilson has always loved road trips. She's 28 and has now been living in a renovated van and traveling across the country since last December with the goal of visiting every national park in the U.S. The Michigan native bought the van last summer, spent 2 months renovating it herself. Fox News says she learned from tutorials on YouTube. The van has a full-size bed, 2 benches, a fridge freezer, a shower, a monitor for gaming, a ceiling fan, and security cameras. Instead of a kitchen, she gets by with a collapsible sink and a camp stove. She continues to work remotely as a product designer at 3 tech startups making $300,000 a year. She's been to 10 national parks and plans to head to parks on the East Coast before it gets cold. $300,000 a year, no rent, no mortgage, no kids. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. Fortunately, GEICO makes it easy to bundle your home and car insurance. It's a good thing, too, because having a home is hard work. Go to GEICO.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. GEICO.com. Easy.